It is episode 2, the Pocket Protectors podcast. I guess we'll go with the catchphrase, the tagline, straight math, homie. My name is Jason Brown. You can find me on Twitter at BrownJason, joined once again by Eric Eager of Pro Football Focus and Luke Braun of Purple PTSD. Eric, what's going on, my man?
Nothing much, man. Just kind of staying up and, you know, reading some math papers and watching old football games on YouTube. You know, regular night.
Well, that is some exciting stuff right there. Luke, how about you, man?
I'm doing great. Just put up a piece that I'm really excited to talk about this morning.
Morning? Where are we reaching you today?
I put up a piece this morning that I'm excited to talk about.
Okay.
Let me rearrange that sentence for you.
All right. Let me keep up here. Well, gentlemen, you know what's been going on with you? I know, Eric, you're having a very exciting night with some math papers right now, but since the last time we talked, what have you guys been up to?
Yeah, I mean, just enjoying what the NFL season has to offer. It was a really interesting week. You had all the home underdogs, and many of them not only covered but won their games outright. So that was a pretty fun week. A little gut wrenching in terms of the picks at PFF, and kind of looking and seeing how our rating systems have worked out. It's kind of fun to look back and see. You know, we had the Giants and the Chargers kind of like 25th and 26th in our power rankings early in the season, and you know, I had a bunch of people on Twitter telling me to basically quit my job or, you know, I should get waterboarded or something. And it ended up, you know, that's nice to see those two teams at 0-3 in hindsight. So I think I actually did get somebody. I showed my colleague George Shahuri the waterboarding comment. We both had a chuckle over it. So we do have, you know, some skin in the game, if you will, in terms of wanting to be right every once in a while. But we, if you go back and look, we were not right about the Vikings this week. And as Vikings fans, it makes us feel a little good, I think.
Yeah, well, we'll take that. We'll take that. And Luke, how about you, man? What have you been up to?
Been watching Lions games for the game coming up, just trying to get my bearings on who they are, because their games are always weird, and I feel like you kind of always have to watch their games just to get a feel for that. But other than that, just working my day job and grinding away.
Good stuff, good stuff. So, Vikings did win. Eric, I know I'm going to put you on the spot here for just a little bit, but, you know, Case Keenum went in there, obviously dropped a 369 career day versus, I think, the Bucks, maybe third-string guys, but it doesn't matter. We'll take it. But one of the things that you've said, you know, consistently and you know, conversations that we've had offline is that, you know, Case Keenum really is kind of the perfect type of backup quarterback because he is such a high-variance guy. And I was wondering if maybe you could give a little bit of an explainer on that for the listeners to help them understand why having a guy like Case Keenum is kind of what you want out of your backup quarterback.
Yeah, so we've done quarterback kind of analysis with PFF and looking at things like how well they grade, what their average depth of completion is, average depth of target, the kind of routes they throw, what kind of style they play. And, you know, what we found is that, you know, there are kind of quarterbacks kind of cluster themselves into groups. And, you know, you have like kind of what we call the GOAT cluster, where you have like the Aaron Rodgers and the, you know, the Tom Brady's and some seasons, the Matt Ryan's and the Russell Wilson's and those kind of guys. And, you know, when you look at that cluster, kind of the conversation starts at about 65% win percentage, right? And that's kind of non-negotiable. If you have one of those guys, you just, you know, thank your lucky stars and move on. But if you're kind of in that second tier, even, you know, you have kind of like the conservative, the Alex Smith and Sam Bradford, Andy Dalton kind of clusters. And then you have kind of the higher variance clusters, the Jameis Winstons, the Cam Newtons, the, you know, at times Joe Flacco, although he's not really effective anymore at anything. Total air yards on Sunday was -1. So he's kind of a different guy now. But you kind of have that differential between guys that throw a lot of really positively graded throws and a lot of negatively graded throws versus guys that kind of play down the middle. And the win percentage for the former is actually quite a bit higher. In the kind of like the Bradford-like clusters, although, you know, Bradford kind of turned the page a little bit in week one, but in those clusters, you're talking about the conversation starting about a 45 to 50% win percentage, where it's more like 50 to 55% for the higher variance guys. And so, you know, you kind of extend that to, you know, when your quarterback's injured, what kind of guy do you want? And I think Keenum's kind of the perfect guy, you know, 58% completion percentage throughout his career. You don't really want that guy to be throwing 5 to 10 yard passes all the time because you're just crossing the road too much. You want him to leverage your strengths, go down the field. And if he ends up with a 3-interception game, you know, you were meant to lose that game anyway when your backup starts. So, you know, on the other side of the coin, you can see what happened Sunday where, you know, you're just getting big chunks of yardage all the time. And those things kind of snowball and the Vikings end up being successful. And I think that that's really the kind of quarterback, you know, you want when you're in a pinch.
Yeah, that's awesome. Analysis. Hey, I really do love that. And then I like the fact that, you know, you really go in there because I really feel like oftentimes when you think about risk in the NFL, coaches don't seem to think like that. Where like you're going in with the backup, you're probably not going to win that game. So why not just, you know, throw caution to the wind and air it out. So it was really nice to see a team, our team, the Vikings, who traditionally, which is very strange, you go out there and you play that wide open style with the backup, who's, you know, a less talented player, and go in there and just open it up and let our skill position guys do what they do, versus, you know, when we do have our top guys in there, be it, you know, Sam Bradford early in the season, who did show improvement, was still towards the bottom of the league from an ADOT perspective, or even when you had Teddy Bridgewater in previous seasons, it was very apparent that Mike Zimmer's risk appetite was not one, you know, like you said, he wants 21 points a game. He doesn't want to be a high-flying, high-risk-taking offense. So it was awesome to see them really go out there and open things up with the man Case Keenum and have us actually put up points and then let the defense do what they're really built to do, which is, you know, let our guys hunt the quarterback. Once we get a lead with, you know, Everson Griffin, Hunter, Robinson in there rushing, like that's what those guys are. That's what they want to do. And it was great to really see a game plan that let those guys get loose with things. So kind of on that same vein, one of the things we do talk about when we're talking about Sam Bradford a lot is obviously the low ADOT. And, you know, Case came in and his ADOT's on the other end of the spectrum. I guess, Eric, is ADOT something that actually matters? Because I know we talk about it a lot when we're kind of, I guess, parsing out a quarterback's risk profile. Is that really the only thing it's good for? Or does it have any other type of value?
Well, I think it you know, it has been shown to be a stable metric, right? So I think, I can't remember who did the study, but it says it stabilizes over about 10 weeks. So it's one of those things you do like to look at when you're trying to develop metrics. You do like to look at things that are stable, right? And ADOT is certainly something that is stable and predictive over time. It's one of those things where if you're looking at, you know, from the fantasy football perspective, you're looking at kind of variance with players. That is certainly a thing, right? If you're a wide receiver and your ADOT is, you know, particularly high, you are, you know, more prone to have games that are, you know, like Stephon Diggs had on Sunday versus, you know, somebody like Cordarrelle Patterson had a really like comical ADOT last year of like 4.8, half lower than anybody else, right? And you kind of knew what to expect from him every game, you know, 2 to 3 catches, 17 yards or so. Whereas guys, you know, that are a little bit more downfield, you know, the DeSean Jackson, those kind of guys, you know, you have, they're good best ball players. You know, one game they're going to get 3 catches for 150 yards and 2 touchdowns. And then some games they disappear because those are higher, you know, the lower completion percentage type plays. So they don't hit as much. So it's certainly an important statistic. It's important to look of, you know, if you're looking at, you know, a guy like Alex Smith and wondering, you know, oh, well, his, you know, yards per attempt is, you know, relatively okay this year, but you look at his average depth of target and it's pretty bad, then maybe you can give more credit to the guys like Travis Kelce, who had the most yards after catch for tight ends last year, or Tyreek Hill, who's very explosive after the catch, that kind of thing. Or you look at a player like Cam Newton a season ago who really struggled. Well, is it because, you know, in 2015, his average depth of target was relatively similar, and he just happens to, you know, get a run of really good cards in 2015 and a run of really crappy cards in 2016. You know, those kinds of things, you can really contextualize, you know, things like yards per attempt, things like passer rating, by looking at something like average depth of target.
That's awesome. And Luke, I know that one of the things that, you know, we've talked about, especially as it relates to, you know, Pat Shurmur, is that, you know, most of the quarterbacks that have played in Pat Shurmur type offenses have been very low ADOT, very low risk type of guys. Does the performance we saw to Case Keenum give you hope that maybe when either Sam or Teddy or whomever, or maybe Case just keeps this party going, that he's changed his ways? Or do you think that was kind of a one-off versus a depleted Buccaneers team, and it's unlikely that we see anything like that as we move forward in the season?
I think it was the game plan for this week. I don't think it had as much to do with the Buccaneers as it did to do with just having a backup quarterback in there, and Pat Shurmur was trying to cater to him. You know, we've seen 3 years of Pat Shurmur with Sam Bradford. We know what he does for Sam Bradford and what he thinks Sam Bradford is capable of. But I think, like, a lot of things about Case Keenum's day against the Bucs, I think, are not going to repeat themselves. Like, let's not start, you know, trading the farm from fantasy and stuff. You're happy to get that kind of, like Eric was talking about with just that high variance. You know, you're happy you got one of the good games and hope you don't need a lot of Case Keenum games, but it's nice that we got a good one.
He definitely won me at least one league in Superflex this past week. So, hey, Bradford went down. I was a desperate man. I had to do what I had to do, man. So Case was out there on the waiver wire. I picked him up, and he led me to victory, both in real football and in fantasy. So stop judging me, Luke.
But I think one of the interesting things to look at, though, is the other side of the coin, right, is that the Jameis Winston is a player who he's leading the league right now in average depth of target. And I've always said you're going to get, I think I even wrote this on the prediction piece, you're going to get 3 to 4 stinkers from Jameis Winston a year. You just are. You look at some of his grades, you look at some of just his like actual statistics for some games, and he's got, you know, a handful of those over the course of his career. And so, you know, the Vikings really, not only did they hit on Keenum doing really well, they also hit on the fact that Jameis Winston underthrew DeSean Jackson right to Trey Waynes. And he threw that one to Sendejo. I don't really know who the receiver was on that play, and so forth, right? And so, but at the same time, like, if he hits a stretch of 4 consecutive games like that, and he happens to be in the playoffs when that happens, something like Joe Flacco 2012 can happen, or even Cam Newton almost all of 2015. You know, those types of things where, again, with Bradford, if you kind of neuter him, like we hope they don't, right, it's really hard for guys like us to envision Bradford putting together 4 straight games like that in the playoffs. And that's kind of the frustrating thing.
Yeah, and they've surrounded him with, in Tampa Bay, they've surrounded him with weapons that, like, catered that. You know, Mike Evans is, I think he's one of the best accuracy erasers in the league. Right. And DeSean Jackson's, you know, no slouch either. They got a big tight end in the first round of the draft. So they're definitely catering to that kind of, trying to erase as much of that inconsistency as possible, so that they can, you know, do right. things like not only having a high variance quarterback, but attempting high variance throws, like deep throws, and just like embracing risk, you know, hoping that you can get more benefit than cost from it.
That's right.
And we have all those, we have some of those things. You started talking about athletic tight ends, and I teared up a little bit there. So I'm going to move things along. And Luke, you wrote an
awesome. You could have had Jared Cook.
He got a touchdown, didn't he?
he's fast. A high variance player.
That is true. That is true.
Yeah.
So Luke, success rate. It's kind of a thing that you know, it's been out there for a while, but it seems that in recent months, it's I've read a lot more pieces about success rate, and you know, RotoViz added success rate to their screener, so you can go in there and you know, play around and do some work in there as well. And you wrote a really awesome piece where, you know, you being you, and I think did all the math yourself. So I guess tell us a little bit about success rate, why it's important, and how it really pertains to what's going on with the Vikings and the success they're having on offense.
Yeah, so for people who don't know what success rate is, it's basically a measure of like if you're ahead of the chains or behind the chains, like how you're doing in down and distance, you know, getting manageable situations. So the way that that's the where that line is drawn is 40% of the yards on first down, 60% of the yards on second down, and then obviously getting all of it on third and fourth down. So if it's first and 10 and you get 4 yards, you can call that a successful play. You set up a second and six, and that's a nice, easy, manageable situation. So I wrote a piece at purpleptsd.com. Please go check it out. Talking about Dalvin Cook and not only his success rate and how well he's done, but like what that means. And you see runs, like there was a highlight going around Twitter of, Dalvin Cook being like dead to rights, you know, 3 yards behind the line of scrimmage. And he managed to turn that into a 3 yard gain instead. And the value of that is just immense because it sets up a second and seven, and that's an easier situation. And then the article goes into like just the stark difference between when the team is ahead of the chains and when the team is behind the chains, you know, when they're in like difficult third and nine situations. And this is true of every team. I think the difference was something like 70 points of passer rating and this crazy success rate stuff with running run plays when you're ahead of the chains versus behind the chains. And it just, you know, it makes this huge impact, which isn't news, but I think success rate does a really good job of like illustrating how important it is to just have successful plays. So when you have, you know, first down runs that only go for a yard, not only is that like disappointing in terms of just like not being, you know, the exciting play you wanted it to be. I think sometimes you call that like, oh, it was a bad play call. It was a bad play call. Well, obviously they didn't expect the play to fail, you know? And I think like success rate is a really good measure for that. And I think the best example that I can think of for success rate is Adrian Peterson. He, for his whole career, had a success rate that was a lot lower than like his total yards and his touchdowns and his yards per attempt, which were the stats everybody was looking at. But if you looked at his success rate because of his whole like famine feast style, his whole career, his success rate was kind of lackluster. And that's why it was really predictable for an age decline to really like hit him like a ton of bricks, because once he loses that like acceleration burst that can lead to those big, long, like 85 yard touchdowns, he's suddenly like losing where he gains the majority of his yards. Like in the article, I wrote something along the lines of, if you have a running back that gets 9 out of 10 plays to be failures, you know, 9 out of 10 plays are 1 or 2 yards or a loss of yards, and then busts 165-yard run. Like, he didn't have a good day. He didn't contribute more to the team, you know, than an average running back. So I think success rate does a really good job of capturing that. And if we paid attention to success rate a little bit earlier, I think we could have had a much easier time predicting Adrian Peterson's decline and possibly, you know, getting out of that situation sooner.
And so when you were looking at success rate, sorry, Eric, so when you were looking at success rate, I guess, and I know that you were really focused on Dalvin Cook and what he's been able to do and turning some of those, you know, losses into gains to keep us ahead of the sticks. I guess, did you also look at, you know, what plays are most effective to run when? I know that, you know, one of Eric's big pet peeves is, you know, running it when you do get behind the chains and how that's basically throwing series away. But I guess, did you get into that at all in terms of, you know, is it better to
that
pass
specifically, or? Yeah, that's absolutely. Like if you're, so success rate, just the way it's measured kind of answers that question, right? Because like if you're a second and 10, say you got an incomplete pass, you're now asking that run play to be a 6 yard run play to be successful and set up a manageable third down situation. Versus a pass play being 6 yards, that's like a whole lot easier. So like running on second and long, there's a kind of nebulous cliche of like, oh, well, we're just trying to get some chunk yardage to make third down easier. But you're really making it like you're putting your offense in such a challenging situation to accomplish that yeah, you're just throwing series away.
And Eric, we know that's your pet peeve, so obviously I need you to jump in here and kind of speak through. So I saw you tweet on it, and your man George was messing with you a little bit when you were like, stop running the ball in all caps on second and long. And I think he tweeted, you know, I'll do what I want or something like that in response to it. So I guess, what are your thoughts on that in terms of success rate? And you know, if you were looking to optimize the way you called plays to give yourself the best chance of success on first, second, and I guess third down.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit on a really interesting point in that, like, I've discovered this actually by talking to people who are, you know, kind of in the trenches with coaches and everything, you know, whether it be fourth down decision making and stuff like that. you know, a lot of these decisions on what plays are called are scripted, and the decisions that are being made, you know, about whether or not to go for it on fourth down are being made on like first and second down, you know, like where, you know, you have the analytics guy in the booth and the offensive coordinator is like, well, is this a four down situation here? And they change the way they call plays based upon it. So it's really odd. I think, you know, we, you know, all of us kind of grew up playing Madden, I think, right? And all of us just make these like split second decisions on what plays to run. You know, it's, oh, it's third and six. Okay, I'm going to run a pass. You know, we don't think like, okay, here's second down, I'm setting up this next play. And so, you know, I think that's where kind of like the best coaches, the Andy Reids and the offensive coordinators, you know, the even like McVay looks to be one of those guys as well. They're calling plays kind of set up by other plays. Whereas, you know, kind of some of the weaker coordinators are saying, okay, my sequence here is, and then whatever I need to do on third down. Well, if the first down pass is incomplete or the first down run is bad and you've already earmarked second down for a run, I don't know how many guys are flexible enough to make that change. But it's certainly, I mean, we talked about last week, if you run the ball on second down and seven or more, you're giving up a quarter of a point every time you do that, which over the course of like, you know, X number of drives a game and you know, over the course of a season, I mean, it's substantial, right? And there's so many, I mean, those are where the inefficiencies are in the NFL. It's just these play-to-play decision-making, you know, processes, the taking the ball out of the, you know, my other pet peeve is taking the ball out of the end zone on kickoffs. All of those different things, there are aggregate points here and there that coaches are losing. And I think looking at it from the perspective of success rate, looking at it from the perspective of expected points, all of those things, you know, I think we're going to get better at it. I just don't necessarily know if the appetite is there to be more efficient, because we've known these things for, I think, a little bit longer than, you know, we have all been friends, for example, you know?
So explain, because, okay, that fires me up, because like that's unbelievable that I didn't know that about coaches just having scripted plays. Like if you've got a run dialed up on second down and your pass falls incomplete, now you're just like willfully making a bad play call because like that's what you had dialed. That seems absurd to me. Seems like what, like if you taught a 6-year-old to play Madden, like what they would do.
Yeah. And I can't remember which book I read this from, but you know, they were talking about kind of the inefficiencies inherent in the game. And they were saying a lot of it is because, so like the example they did was Sean Payton, who actually Sean Payton's become kind of Jeff Fisherized late in his career. But like, let's think about good Sean Payton and like Jason Garrett, right? And Jason Garrett played in the NFL for about, you know, a decade. He wasn't calling plays, and now he's calling plays for Dallas. And he has been for, you know, let's say the last 10 years or so, right? And he only has 10 years of practice calling plays. And Sean Payton has those 10 years plus the 10 years he was calling plays before that. He's going to be just better at it. But he was, you know, the author of the book, I'll have to give it out on Twitter or something, but was making the argument that these people just simply don't practice these, you know, quick fire, you know, decision-making processes that are necessary, and sort of resort to, you know, kind of the tried and true thing, tried and not true, but tried and what is thought of as true things. Like think about something as silly as going for two. Right. There was somebody on, I can't remember which game I was talking about the other day, but the one of the teams scored and it got them within two, and it was like 3 minutes left in the third quarter. And the announcer was like, well, it's too early to go for two. And I'm like, right? Like, go for two now because
– Yeah, so you know. You know.
So you know, and you can tie the game. And if you don't tie the game, you know, right, as opposed to – but it's like we have these default positions that we accept without even thinking about them, right? You run the ball on second down if you pass it on first down. And nobody's ever bothered to ask why. And I think it's because, you know, obviously the mob mentality, if you make the same wrong decisions as everybody else, then when the thing comes crashing down, you can never say, well, you know, I'm not overly stupid. I'm just like everybody else. It's, you know, there's some hedging going on there in terms of, you know, what these people are making in terms of decisions. But, it, you know, it is. It does boil my blood a little bit, but you know,
it's just amazing to me that we can't find 32 people in the world that can know what to do on second down when your pass falls incomplete.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, all the coaches that we grew up watching just haven't had as many sons as we need to fill out the rest of the league, or sons who studied math.
Well,
to solve this problem for us,
right? And I mean, that's a great point, right? Because like you look at Scott, like, and I don't know anything about Scott Turner, but like you know, Scott Turner's the quarterback coach of the Vikings last year. He just happens to be one of the 32 most qualified people for that position. I'm just putting that up as kind of like a, you know, as an example, but it is exactly that, right? Like there are just these, you know, sort of inefficiencies where you default to, oh, he's Norv Turner's son. You know, he's probably good at it, you know? And that kind of like nepotism is obviously going to breed inefficiencies, I think.
So again, I'm gonna put you guys in the spot because Luke said something that just made me that made this thought pop in my mind here. So obviously Adrian Peterson, great player, cornerstone of the Vikings franchise for many, many years, made the team exciting to watch, even though we didn't win a lot when he was here, for some of the reasons that when you start to really dig into his performance in terms of success rate and his feast or famine style. So as you look at it, and you know, these are probably not the best examples. If this is something I planned for, I'd probably do a little bit better, but I guess if you were now thinking about, you know, the type of person that you were going to build your franchise, the type of running back you wanted to build your franchise around, would you choose to have someone who's obviously superiorly, a superior talent in an Adrian Peterson, but understanding that you are going to get that feast or famine running style, or a guy like, you know, Frank Gore, who doesn't seem to really be the uber athlete, but he's pretty much going to get you 3.5 yards at least on every single carry forever. So I guess Luke, you're the one who brought this question to my mind. So I'll put you on the spot with it first.
I definitely am gonna, I mean, all other things being equal, which are like the cheaper one, because I'm a big proponent of like chewing up running backs and spitting them out. Cause I think that they're relatively cheap and you can just sort of like churn through young ones on rookie deals and never pay too much. But I want the one who's going to have more successful plays, who's going to set up my quarterback to do better things. So I guess that means the consistent one. If we're talking about, you know, one who's going to maybe bust a run, but always be looking for it and then like choose the wrong hole and lead to unsuccessful plays. I want the consistent one who can get you 3.5, 4 yards every time and set up manageable things for a young quarterback if I'm building a team.
How about you, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, the thought that came to my head when I was listening to Lou talk about Peterson was Barry Sanders, right? You know, he was the typical, you know, I remember a playoff game against the Packers. He had like 13 carries for minus 1 yard or something like that. And he was very much the feast, you know, the famine, feast guy. And, you know, he's a Hall of Famer, one of the best players to ever play the game, obviously. But Detroit never really amounted to much with him. I think they won one playoff game his entire tenure. Very similar to the Vikings, right? The Vikings won one playoff game in Peterson's tenure. And I think that, you know, Emmitt Smith's not the fair comparison because they had Aikman and Irvin and a really, you know, Dave Wanstead's defenses for Dallas were really good. You know, but I'm trying to think, you know, you look at, you know, the teams that, you know, Pittsburgh's won a couple Super Bowls with running backs for which they didn't have to invest much, you know, the Willie Parkers of the world. The Patriots haven't really invested a whole lot of anything in the running back position, you know, in any of their, you know, Super Bowl runs. I think Corey Dillon was probably the most they put in that position at that time. You know, and they have obviously had success. The Packers were sort of comical in the players that they put at the running back position the year they won the Super Bowl. Ryan Grant was out the entire year. You know, so I think the proof is in the pudding. I mean, if you're for one, I think the answer is you just don't start a team with a running back. And if you know, it's just one of those positions where you just flip a lot of coins and hopefully you end up, you know, as it looks, you know, with guys like Kareem Hunt and Tariq Cohen and Dalvin Cook, you know, none of those guys were drafted in the first round and they look every bit as good, if not better, than the guy drafted fourth overall by the Jaguars, you know? And I think that that's really the, you know, the proof where the proof is in the pudding there for us.
That logic is why I don't think we're going to see Jerick McKinnon be a Viking next year. Like, I don't know what kind of contract to give him and what that's worth when you could easily just draft a replacement that gives you exactly as much value, if not more.
Yeah, and I wonder about whether or not he gets, you know, really anything in free agency either. I mean, you look at only you know, the Jaguars are just kind of like this marvel of silliness, but like, you know, Chris Ivory got a decent contract and Leonard Fournette got drafted fourth overall. But other than that, I really haven't seen, you know, running backs, you know, get these kind of big deal. I mean, Amon Green to Houston was one that was kind of a horrible bust. And you look even like at Le'Veon Bell has been really underwhelming through the first 3 weeks. And I think, you know, Pittsburgh is very much thinking like, okay, we're just going to string these years together with the franchise tag until the tires fall off and then off on the, you know, basically probably the Jaguars, you know? And I think that's smart.
Yeah, I think he's probably looking at a Latavius Murray kind of deal where you get maybe one solid year of like $3 million, which is decent money, and no guarantees really beyond that or nothing significant beyond that. And then you kind of have to earn your keep year over year, just like all the rest of these guys are. It's a big rat race.
Yeah. LeGarrette Blount is taking 1 year deals for the rest of his career. I mean, it's the way it is.
Yep, and we are in 100% agreement on that one. I am of the mind, even though, and maybe this is something we can get into on the next pod, is that I'm very much of the mind that, you know, you want to get your guy and, you know, keep just a stable of young, inexpensive running backs on the roster, spread that risk around, since we know that you know, running backs touch the ball more often, they get hit more often, they're most likely to get injured. But it does tie into something else that I can't remember whose piece it was that I saw on Twitter today that said that Dalvin Cook was, I think, second in the league in touches at this point in the season. And so it was a conversation that I did have with some of the guys from Climbing the Pocket around, you know, do we really want Dalvin having that many touches, even though he is getting better in the second half? It seems that a lot of running backs get better in the second half as defenses get tired. And I've kind of been of the mind that I want Dalvin in there when I need to score points and get the league. But I'm okay with Latavius Murray, who I don't think is particularly good, going in there and just taking those hits as we bleed clock at the end of the game. Because if he goes down and gets hurt in the third or fourth quarter, we can put CJ Hammond. It's not like the end of the world for the team. Whereas, you know, Dalvin Cook going down, I think, would be a much bigger loss than we might be able to overcome based on what he's been able to accomplish for us thus far.
Yeah, it doesn't matter who's carrying the rock. They all make the defense just as tired. And when the defense is tired, you know, like Latavius Murray is maybe not $3.5 million worth of running back, but he's not like a bad running back. He's still fine. He can absolutely grind out the clock and take a bunch of punishment. And then we keep our young, fresh, shiny new toy, you know, a little bit cleaner throughout the year so that when it gets down to those cold playoff games, like in Lambeau, or I think we have to play a week 17 game. Oh no, that's a home game. Like if there's a cold playoff game or something, you know, that's when you want to have a guy who's fresh, who hasn't been beat to hell all year.
I think the most refreshing thing about Dalvin Cook is if they go through a game and the game flow dictates that they're going to throw the ball 50 to 60 times and Dalvin Cook gets four carries and, you know, seven receptions, we're never going to have to answer the questions that we always had to answer about Adrian Peterson was, where was Peterson? You know, there was always, you know, there was never a game where the Vikings were allowed to let the game flow dictate how many carries Peterson got. And I think it always hamstrung their offense. You know, you saw it from San Francisco week one of 2015 was the one time they tried to kind of let the game flow with Teddy and everything sort of blew up. I like that about Cook in that he can contribute in other ways. I like the fact that they've only invested the 40, you know, something pick in him and the salary that goes with that. I like every bit of that because, you know, when you draft a running back number seventh, you know, seventh overall, or in the case of the Jaguars, fourth overall, there's expectations that go with that. And those expectations were always embedded into the Vikings offense. And it never allowed them it never allowed for them to ad lib on the fly, except for possibly the Favre year. But even then, Peterson was still, they were still manufacturing carries for him, which I think just simply slows your offense down to some degree.
Yeah, I think it was in the 2015 season or right after it, Arif did a piece that about like predictability, and it was a Norv Turner piece. And I think there was something crazy in there, like when Adrian Peterson took the ball on like 80% of his snaps or something like that. And like, you know, when the Vikings got behind and they had to pass, you can't use Adrian Peterson in those situations because he was just useless. He was like having 10 men on the field. He couldn't block. He couldn't catch. He was a liability in those situations. And Dalvin Cook is not, which is incredibly refreshing.
Yep. 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 Love it. Love it. Love it. And love what this offense is turning into. Excited because one of my coworkers is a staunch Detroit Lions fan, and the trash talk has already started. So I'm very excited for Sunday to get here so we can see how that's going, because I also have started watching some of the Lions games, talking to some of my buddies back in Atlanta about how that game with the Lions went. And unlike you, Luke, it seems that not just this season, but even going back to last year and even years before that, a lot of luck, a lot of strange bounces seem to go the Lions' way a lot of times towards the end of these games. So I'm excited to go out there because just based even with the injuries and things they've had recently, I think that, you know, outside of quarterback, we have some favorable matchups really across the board going into this one. So excited to see how it plays out. Hope the team doesn't have a letdown going into this week. And yeah, excited to see how it all goes. So before we get this thing wrapped up here, I guess, you know, it's I know that you guys have some of the regular weekly things that you do every week. But I guess, Eric, starting with you, I guess, what is the next thing that listeners should be looking for from you, and where can they find it?
Yeah, I mean, just tomorrow we'll have the Pro Football Focus ELO ratings. The Vikings, I can give you guys a head start. They jumped to 14th this week, which I think still is probably too low for many Vikings fans, but certainly an increase from where they started the season, so that's pretty cool. And then coming out Friday, we'll have I'll have my spot on the PFF podcast as well as our picks. Yep, last week we went 3-2. We were wrong on a Case Keenum game and a Blake Bortles game. Bets we're gonna gladly take when they present themselves. Those kinds of things, and writing here and there for PFF, tweeting about the Vikings and sort of the love hate relationship that they elicit. So we're looking forward to this coming game against Detroit. Hopefully the Vikings can stop their two-game losing streak to the Lions.
Good stuff, good stuff. And how about you, Luke? What else you got coming for us?
Yeah, you can always find me on the Purple Journal, which comes out Thursday mornings. You can find my articles come out Tuesday mornings on purpleptsd.com. I'm probably going to write about Stephon Diggs and maybe Adam Thielen, because right now they're, I think, third and fifth, respectively, in yards per route run, which is insanity. They're both better than Mike Evans right now. And that's weird, statistically, and that's weird to say, and I want to write about it. So unless something in the Lions game comes up that truly, inspires me to write about that instead, I'll probably write about Diggs, and you can look forward to that.
Good stuff. Always here for more Stephon Diggs takes. Glad that he is being used the way he is being used this year, and that it seems that, if anything, the one thing that I will give, because I have been, a critic of Shermer and the coaching staff and the way that they were using Stephon Diggs, was terrified they were going to turn him into Jarvis Landry after what happened last season. And it's awesome to see that it looks like they went and self-scouted and have realized that Stephon Diggs is our best wide receiver, possibly our best player. We need to feature him all over the field, which includes throwing to him in the red zone. So that's awesome. And I'm looking forward to that, hoping that the Vikings just cruise to victory so that you can write about Stephon Diggs for us next week.
Maybe no self-scouts this year.
But I guess that's it for this week. We'll go ahead and get this thing wrapped up, and we'll be back next week with some more math, some more football, and hopefully celebrating another Vikings win. We'll talk to you guys soon. See ya.